Welcome to this week's episode of Tour Justice Weekly. This is Colin Miller. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how are you doing?
Hey, Colin. I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. And today we are proud to be joined by Josh Sharp. Josh is a print and audio journalist and editor. He is a 2025 Type Media Fellow and a 2023 to 2024 Knight Wallace Fellow. In 2021, he won numerous awards for his documentary, The Imperfect Alibi. That documentary is about the Dennis Perry case that we covered in our third season of Undisclosed, and the Dennis Perry case is also the subject of his recent book, The Man No One Believed, The Untold Story of the Georgia Church Murders. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Hi, Josh.
So let's go ahead and start by reorienting listeners to the basic details of the Dennis Perry case. So on March 11th, 1985, Thelma and Harold Swain are murdered inside the Rising Daughter Baptist Church in Waverly, Georgia. Initially, the case is unsolved. It even appears in an infamous episode of Unsolved Mysteries before a new team comes in on the case more than a decade and a half later, and that leads to Dennis Perry being eventually convicted for the crime in 2002. Now, Josh, to start things off, as you note in your book, you grew up pretty close to where this murder occurred and even have somewhat of a connection to the Swains, right?
Well, yeah, I definitely grew up near there. I don't have personal connections to them, but I will say I have connections to the way that they lived and the place that they lived. You know, they both lived near the Zatilla River and grew up there. And that's the same river I grew up on, about 40 minutes away. This is in extreme southeast Georgia, in a place called Camden County on the coast and on the border with Florida. Very, very rural community. And this church is one of those little country churches you see when you're driving down the road through my part of the world. Yeah.
And how much did it help you think in investigating this case, having grown up in that area?
It helped me a ton. I mean, because I had all kinds of connections, I realized. Dennis Perry was prosecuted by a man named John B. Johnson III, and for, I think, like 50 years or something, my grandmother cleaned his teeth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My grandmother, Margaret Sharp, she was a dental hygienist for 50 years in the same county where John lived and cleaned everybody's teeth.
Josh, I'm not trying to date you here. You look pretty young to me, but I'm like, in 1985 is when these murders occurred. Do you have any recollection of this happening, of the actual event?
I hadn't been born.
You hadn't been? That's what I figured.
I was born in 86.
Okay, wow. Okay, yeah, that's true. I was listening to Michael Jackson back then, so I was like, he looks a little younger to me.
Yeah. And so, Robbie, I don't know if you remember this, but we initially were not supposed to cover Dennis's case. So Susan right. Simpson was the lead investigator. She was deep into another investigation that kind of fell through. We had worked with the Georgia Innocence Project on the Joy Watkins case. And so they brought us the Dennis Perry case. And they said, actually, Colin, you're probably not going to take this case because he's waived any right he has to an appeal.
Right.
I like a challenge. And when I saw the files, I thought this is a case of wrongful conviction. Josh, my understanding is that, and our coverage showed, and your book shows as well, after Dennis is convicted in 2002 and he has a sentencing hearing, he has to make this fairly quick decision, right, about what to do with his sentencing hearing, right?
Yeah, yeah. So this was a death penalty trial. And the way that goes is, you know, you get convicted of guilt or innocence. And then after that, there's another phase of it where you go in to figure out whether the jury will send you to death row or whether they'll recommend life without parole. And after Dennis was convicted, he had so little time. And we're talking about minutes or at most an hour or something to decide on this offer that the state had suddenly given, which was, hey, if you waive your right to ever appeal, then we could forget about the whole death penalty thing and just put you on life without parole. And at the time, Dennis, you know, he has told me, he may have also told you all that I mean, he just had to go on instinct then, you know, he didn't want to die. You know, he wanted to live. So he said, okay, I'll do it. I'll take it.
This was offered after he was convicted, is that right?
Yes,
Okay.
after he was convicted.
Yeah, it's an unconscionable position to be in. It's really a Sophie's choice, yeah.
That's just so terrifying. And also, you know, it's also rather unsettling when you think about the fact that the Swain's family did not support the death penalty.
Right.
And they had told, my understanding, my reporting shows that they had told people that. I'm talking about the authorities. They had told them that. So I always wondered, you know, did the state ever really intend to seek the death sentence, or was that something that they wanted to use to have leverage over it, you know?
Right. And so from your book, my understanding is, so we did our coverage, season three of Undisclosed with the Georgia Innocence Project. And then my understanding from the book is the Georgia Innocence Project reaches out to you and asks, you know, Undisclosed has covered this. Can you look into this further? And how did that conversation go when the GIP is reaching out to you and asking you to cover this case?
So they asked me out to coffee to talk about covering a case. And the reason was they had read the investigative story I had written about whether or not there was a cancer cluster going on in some with some rare childhood cancers in my hometown, Waycross. And, you know, knowing I was from the area, thinking that maybe I could help. And also I work for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And if you're trying to get attention for something in Georgia, especially something that lawmakers or people in power could do something about, you want to be in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So they came to me. They initially, I didn't mention this in the book, they initially talked about the Joey Watkins case, which y'all obviously know very well, did great work on. But then Claire, who was then the head of the organization, called me and said, you know, what about this Dennis Perry case? So they were, thinking that that one would be something that I could really dig more into, particularly because I was from down there. And but they didn't realize how many connections I would have to various players in this, which definitely just helped so much.
Was that the first time you had heard about this case? Is like after our coverage and when they reached out, or
Yeah.
yeah, wow, okay.
I was shocked because, you know, I mean, like we discussed, I wasn't alive when this happened, but I mean, my God, how do you not hear about, how is this not something that we talk about every year on the anniversary, or, you know, in the whole area? How is it there's not a, you know, a dedication ceremony or a big plaque somewhere or a statue or something? I mean, this is huge. And also, 2015, was it that Charleston happens when the racist
Dylann Roof,
person kills the people at Mother Emanuel? Nobody brings this case up at that point either. Like, I can't believe it.
And so comparing that to the Dylann Roof case, right? This is a case where a white man enters an African American church and he murders Harold and Thelma Swain. A pair of glasses that are believed to belong to the shooter are found there. And in our reporting, we were looking at alternate suspects, and one of them was a man named Eric Spar. And just quoting from our podcast where we discussed him, if there had been a checklist of the known attributes of the killer at Rising Daughter, the description of Eric Spar would seem to tick off just about every box. The Frankenstein 3-in-1 glasses, the boots, the missing overshirt that would have been torn off in the shooting, the white t-shirt underneath that some of the witnesses had seen, plus Eric Spar was a welder and a mechanic, the two professions suggested by the slag marks and the glasses found at the church. And Spar had shoulder-length brownish hair, not far off from what the witnesses described. And Josh, as you note in reporting, Susan and us, we sort of had to finish our series, which is quite long as it was, and we didn't get to quite follow up and tick off Eric Spar and everything we might find on him. And so when you first were given this case, how quickly did Eric Spar set off bells in your head?
Well, you know, initially when they brought up this case to me, and I realized that it had been covered by y'all, and then I looked at how in-depth everything you've done was, I thought, well, how in the world am I going to add anything to what they've done? I mean, they could write two books with everything they found. But then I listened to the show, and I heard, I remember that part that you just read very well, and I thought, yeah, y'all are right. He is checking off a lot of boxes. So I immediately thought, you know, okay, here was this guy who, in addition to things you just described, the record showed, or the records alleged, you could say, that he told his first and second ex-wives that he did this. One of those times he was on tape saying this allegedly. And I thought about, you know, being from around there, I thought about some of the people I've met through the years, you know, hanging around in the backwoods and on the river and stuff. And then I thought, you know, some of these folks have kept repeatedly telling me that they killed two black people and bragging about it using racist slurs, then I might be inclined to believe them. Why aren't we believing this guy?
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the reason was his alibi. So I decided to look into that.
Right. And that's the documentary, The Imperfect Alibi, which could apply to both Dennis as well as Eric. And yeah, in terms of this alibi, right, what is the alibi that Eric Spar has that leads this cold case team to say he's not our guy, it's Dennis Perry?
So the alibi was that Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent had spoken with his supervisor at a Winn-Dixie grocery store in Brunswick, Georgia. Brunswick, Georgia is the nearest city of any size to where the church is located. And this alibi said that he had been on the clock for I can't remember how many hours. It was a really long shift where he had been working from early in the day to deep into the night, certainly encompassing the time around 9 p.m. when the murders happened. So that's why he'd been dropped.
Right. And then, as you detail in the book, you follow up on the supposed supervisor. And what do you find in your investigation regarding the supervisor?
Well, to just be blunt, I found that his supervisor was never existed.
Mm.
You know, there's a person listed there on the paper, you know, and there's a name, social security number, work telephone number, home phone number. And none of these things match any person who's ever existed, as far as I can tell.
So all of this information is contained in a police report?
Yes, a GBI report.
Okay. And what did you conclude about how this information came together on that report?
Well, there's still some mystery to it. I'll tell you what I found out. What I found out was that the work phone number that ought to belong to the Winn-Dixie, you know, grocery store, actually didn't even belong to a business. It belonged to the home of a widow. And I talked with her daughter. And her daughter told me that in 1986, which was a year after the murders, which is when Eric was being investigated, she said that her father had passed away, but he had installed a phone in their shed out in the back of the house. And there was some sort of like halfway house or something nearby or next door, and people from there had been caught using that phone. She thought maybe somebody could have used the phone. I asked the GBI agent where he would have gotten the phone number and the name and everything of the boss. And he said back in those days before Google, he may well have just gotten it from Eric himself. I also talked with multiple people who told me that Eric had a tendency to pretend to be other people on the phone. I'll give you one example, a telling example. Once back in the 80s at some point, his ex-wife got a call at work. Or his current wife at the time, his second wife, got a call at work saying that Eric had been in Texas, and she knew he'd been in Texas, and Eric had just been killed in a shootout with the police. His truck was all full of bullet holes, and he was full of holes, and she was going to have to identify the body. So his wife is horrified, and she's thinking, oh, my God, what about his poor mother? Because his mother is generally considered to have been a really nice lady and someone who was just nice, you know, just a nice person, apparently. So she wanted to be the wife wanted to be the one to break the news, this terrible news about Eric being killed by the police in Texas. So she goes to the mother's house and knocks on the door. And who opens the door but Eric and his father, falling over laughing.
Wow.
So, you know, like I say, it's still a mystery exactly how this report and alibi came to be. We've got some context clues, you know.
So it seems like somebody made a phone call from this particular number to the GBI, and they took the report over the phone, and that was it? There was no follow-up on, like, verifying who was calling?
The agent told me this was done over the phone, and the report, the wording of the report indicates that it was done over the phone. There were two conversations. One, the first call to the person from the agent said the person said that they needed to check with corporate to get his time cards or whatever, and they'd be back in touch. Then the detective, about 2 weeks later, I believe it was, receives a call, somebody saying that they're that manager and they've got the information. And also in there, it says that the supervisor talked with other people who were working that night, and they remembered him being there. And I thought that was really strange because it had been a whole year since the murders when we're talking about. Why would you remember that he was there? Because it wasn't today. Today, if we were all at work tonight and this terrible thing happened, we might hear about it. But back then, you're not necessarily.
They had no reason to remember.
Right, how do they remember this, you know? And I did find the man who really was the manager of that store back then, and he had the same last name as the man named in the report, and he told me, "I never spoke with the police. I would remember that. This was the biggest news for years. And I never had anybody else in this store who had the same last name as me. I'm the only one."
A lot of you may not know this, but my father was a veterinary doctor, and I grew up not just around animals, but taking care of animals. I worked at his veterinary clinic all through high school and college, and I learned a lot just being around his patients and being around him as to kind of the signs to look out for when a beloved pet might have an allergy. Now, if you have a dog that tends to like itch, scratch, rub, lick its paws, you know, shake their head, your puppy's eaten grass, you know, they're prone to ear infections, or they have diarrhea, poor digestion. Well, guess what? These are not normal doggy behaviors. They're actually signs of allergies, and a lot of people do not realize that. Allergies in dogs flare up when bad bacteria take over the gut because 90% of your dog's immune system lives in the gut. And just like people, dogs need probiotics or good bacteria to strengthen their gut and calm an overactive immune system. That's why I recommend BetterWild Allergy Relief Soft Chews. It is a supplement designed to support your pet's allergy defense system by strengthening their digestion. They are the first and only chews with ancestral advantage wolf probiotics, which are derived from your dog's mighty ancestor, the wolf. And these probiotics help restore a healthy balance of good bacteria in the gut. The BetterWild Allergy Supplement Chews include four key ingredients: a premium blend of wolf probiotics, L-sackii, which is derived from kimchi. It's been clinically proven to reduce itchiness and redness in just 2 months with daily use. They've got colostrum to boost immune function and fight inflammation, and salmon oil to support healthy skin and fur. BetterWild is committed to helping your dogs with science-backed, veterinarian-approved solutions that you can feel great about. And believe me, if it's veterinarian-approved, I am on board. Right now, BetterWild is offering our listeners up to 40% off your order at betterwild.com/justice. That's betterwild.com/justice for up to 40% off your order. betterwild.com/justice.
And so you're able to sort of unclear Eric Spar, who had been cleared based upon his alibi, and then returning to those glasses in the infamous episode of Unsolved Mysteries. We have Robert Stack with the glasses found at the church, and those glasses disappear. But luckily, the hairs from the glasses had been retrieved before that, and a profile had been developed, and mitochondrial DNA is able to linked DNA to a maternal line. And so after the alibi is gone for Eric Spar, what then transpires in terms of these hairs and Spar's mother, who you mentioned earlier?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how it happened to me.
Yeah.
So after finding out that Spar's alibi couldn't be substantiated, I talked with him. I sent him a letter and I explained to him I'm working on a story about the murders. And, I understand that you've been cleared as a suspect, but I'm having some trouble and figuring out your alibi. I want to talk. He calls me and he tells me he didn't do it, you know, certainly. And he's very agitated by my questions and rather agitated when we're talking. But we talk a few times. I want to do an interview so I can let him know everything I found.
Right.
I want to do it in person. And I suggest a restaurant for us to meet. He says, no, we got to do it at my house. I'm too busy working around here. I've got gardening to do. Thanks. That's what he said. And I said, well, I just, we're going to, let's talk about it. Fine. And anyway, in the interim of trying to arrange a meeting with him, I got a call from Eric. And Eric is saying, you just came to my house and took a clipping of my mama's hair talking about doing a DNA test. And you pretended you were a GBI agent. I'm not talking to you anymore. I said, wait, what? I didn't know what the hell he was talking
about. Right, right. You're in the dark. You have no idea that this
I don't. First of all, I've never misrepresent myself, who I am, you know. And he said, I know it wasn't the GBI because they didn't leave a card. And when he said that, I said, well, yeah, that sounds like not the GBI.
Yeah.
And it turns out it was the Georgia Innocence Project.
Right. I remember when all that happened. It was crazy.
I had, you know, asked for their take on what I had found with this alibi stuff. And unbeknownst to me, they were so concerned by it that they decided to try to do a DNA test on Eric. They said they tried this. They had tried to find a sample before, but just tried a couple times and couldn't do it. So then after the alibi stuff happened, they sent their investigator on a mission to get Eric's DNA, and he followed Eric around a lot, you know, trying to get a cigarette butt. But I guess Eric didn't throw them out the window. And eventually this investigator decides that he would just go to Eric's house where he lived with his mom when Eric wasn't home and simply ask, hey, and say who he was. And hey, with the Georgia Innocence Project, you know, we're investigating this case. And she told him, I know my son didn't do it. Sure. And she gave him the hairs.
Right. And our listeners likely already know the result, but right, what's the result of that mitochondrial DNA testing?
Well, one of the last things Eric said before he hung up on me that day, when he accused me of being the one who took the hair, is this DNA test will prove that I didn't do it.
Right.
That wow.
Did not come to pass.
Yeah.
It was a match to his mitochondrial line, and he is the only person in his mitochondrial line known to have allegedly told multiple people that he's the one who did this, as well as the other things like the glasses description, the tapes and all that we've discussed.
Yeah.
So this changed everything.
Yeah. Josh, can you remind our listeners why, and me, why Eric was on the radar for this investigation to begin with, and what was his connection to the victims?
Yeah, he came up as a suspect nearly a year to the day after the murders, when the family of his first ex-wife, a woman named Emily, came forward to say that he had been calling their house, threatening them, and in the process confessing to the murders. And they said that they had him recorded on tape saying, and this is quoted in the report, saying, I'm the motherfucker who killed the two N-words in the church, and I'll kill y'all too if I have to do it in church. Well, that was the reason that he came
okay.
on as a suspect.
Okay. And that happened, like you said, like a year after the murders took place. But it wasn't until, like, I think Dennis Perry wasn't arrested until 2002, I believe.
He was arrested in 2000.
The trial was in 2002, yeah.
Okay.
The trial was 2003. I didn't want to correct you, but...
Okay.
The family reports this, but then that alibi is what saves him then, eliminates him. That's how it went down.
And so the state, as you report in the book, the state responds how initially to this DNA testing?
They do nothing.
Yeah.
They take no action, as far as I can tell. And that goes on for weeks. I publish my first stories about it. Still, they're not doing anything. But then finally, one day, I got a call saying that District Attorney Jackie Johnson was asking the GBI to reopen the investigation into the church murders, which was just, you know, an insane development, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
35 years after this murder, they've got somebody in prison for it. And now they're reopening the investigation. And you'll remember that this was around the time of the Ahmaud Arbery case.
Right.
Yeah.
In Brunswick. And she was one of the DAs who got a lot of criticism for her handling of it. And there was a firestorm surrounding her with that when they found out about the DNA test and all this, or certainly when my stories were running and everything. So there was so much going on there.
And then how does it feel for you, having worked in this case for years, doing your documentary, working for the AJC and preparing for this book, when there's the hearing and Dennis Perry has his convictions thrown out? How does that feel to you, having worked in this case for so long?
It was really surreal, I got to tell you. It was so surreal. I was obviously grateful because at that point I had become familiar enough with the evidence to understand that the case the state presented against Dennis Perry was bogus. You know, it was a story that made no sense from the very beginning. And it was a story where the witness testimony did not line up with each other, often not even with themselves. It was a tragedy on top of a horrific tragedy, the double murder of two people in a church, you know, and the idea that not only was his conviction being overturned, but his conviction was being overturned because, largely because of this evidence against Eric,
right,
and the investigation into that. That was just, it was really hard to believe that it was all happening, but I was glad that it was, certainly, because I thought that they needed to investigate Eric and to figure out what they could, if they, you know, figure out what they could after all these years.
And all your work is detailed in your book, The Man No One Believed Again. And you said, we had pretty comprehensive coverage and you wondered going in, what else could I find? And there's from having read the book and really enjoyed it, there's a lot that you find in there. And there's a lot of context you give around the surrounding areas and all the players involved. And then all of this finally in the end leads to late 2024 and the report that Eric Spahr is arrested in connection with these murders. And so what is your thought process and feeling when you hear that he's been arrested?
That was shocking.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I had followed the GBI investigation closely. You know, I'd done a good job of sourcing on it. And I expected him to be arrested much sooner.
Right.
Much, much sooner. And the GBI also expected him to be arrested much sooner, is my understanding. But the new district attorney's office, while they did assign someone to review all the evidence, they didn't give them the resources, apparently, to make it a priority. So it rocked on for a long, long, for multiple years, I believe, before it was charged, after the GBI was done with its investigation. This often happens with cold cases. Obviously, you know, there's an emphasis put on cases that are new, and with good reason, right? I mean, the people who've most recently committed violent acts are the ones who are more likely to do it again.
Right.
So there was a big delay. I'd also been in contact with the DA's office, so I thought that maybe it would happen, but we'll see. And yeah, I mean, it was stunning, but I'll tell you this, it keeps getting more stunning. You know, the trial, there were new revelations.
Yeah.
We were jumping ahead a little bit, but he went on trial in October.
He did not plead guilty.
He did not. He's pled not guilty. And he's denied that he's ever told anyone that he was involved. And there are more than 10 witnesses who say that he made statements about killing two black people. And multiple times he said in the church in Camden County, but allegedly. But anyway, so he went on trial in October. And one of the first things that comes out is that Emily has passed away. Well, she was murdered also. Emily is Eric's first ex-wife. Eric's first ex-wife had been murdered in 2013. But her brother was the one who made the recording back in 1986 when Eric was allegedly threatening them and saying that he had done the killings in the church. Well, this brother, his name is Chad. A few months before the trial, a thought occurs to him. And that is that, wait, didn't I make a copy of that tape and keep it and save it at mom's house? Because this tape had gone missing. Nobody had ever heard this tape, or nobody had heard it since 86, apparently. And that was a big problem. Well, Chad goes to his mom's house and he finds a tape.
Incredible.
And it's one of the first things played at trial.
Wow.
And I was so disappointed to not be there to hear in person, obviously. But there was shortly thereafter a mistrial declared because one of my understanding is a witness mentioned another criminal case that Eric had, and the judge found that prejudice to the jury. So
Character evidence, yeah.
the retrial is going to be in March,
Right.
March 12th, I think.
It is after the holidays, and like so many of you, I also took a trip away from home just to spend some time with family. But I cannot lie, the thing I missed most about being away from home is a home-cooked meal. I always think about what is the first thing I'm going to make in my own kitchen when I get back, because there's just nothing like it. But sometimes you run out of ideas, and that's where HelloFresh comes in. HelloFresh brings back the joy of the kitchen with recipes that feel good and taste delicious night after night. I am a prolific home cook, but like so many people, I've got the same rotation over and over, and I just run out of ideas. And my kids, well, they want to eat home-cooked food, but they want some variety as well. And HelloFresh has over 100 mouth-watering recipes every week, from seasonal favorites to global dishes. Now, my kids have a pretty sophisticated palate, so they love all the global variety that HelloFresh provides, two of their favorites being their teriyaki chicken tenders and then ginger beef stir fry, because we love Asian food in this house. But HelloFresh also has amazing Italian and Mediterranean and Mexican recipes. Really, they've got everybody's taste buds covered. The box comes to your door, everything is in it, every single wholesome ingredient you need, because HelloFresh only uses wholesome ingredients like sustainably sourced seafood and 100% antibiotic and hormone-free chicken. Also, they've got seasonal produce from stone fruit to corn on the cob. The meals are so simple to prepare. They take 30 minutes that, guess what? Even your kids can do it. So go to HelloFresh.com/towardjustice10FM to get 10 free meals. The FM stands for free meals. And you'll get a free Zwilling knife, which is $144.99 value on your third box. Once again, go to HelloFresh.com/towardjustice10FM to get 10 free meals and a free Zwilling knife, almost $145 value on your third box. Offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied as a discount on first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. The iconic Classic Full Zip Hoodie is the jacket that started it all for American Giant. Custom heavyweight fleece and side panels for mobility make it the best hoodie ever. And a double-lined hood and reinforced elbow patches means this hoodie will last. Born from a commitment to support the communities that create its products, every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. The result is durable clothing, like the premium Slub Crew tee, no BS high-rise pant, and slim roughneck pant that become part of your life. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip. And save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Colin, as our resident evidence professor, that tape, that's not evidence that's like excludable, or like there's no grounds to, because I wonder, I'm surprised they let it in. I don't know why. I thought maybe that would be some kind of hearsay or something.
Well, the brother would be able to authenticate it as having made the recording, and it's a statement by the defendant, so that is a hearsay exclusion for a statement of a party opponent, a statement by a criminal defendant offered by the prosecution. So,
see, I don't remember all the exclusions from 25 years ago in law school. I got to take your class all over again. Okay.
Well, speaking about old cases, so, you know, Josh, this is not the only case we've done dual investigations on, and this...
I'm just following y'all, yeah.
And doing great work in doing so. And I want to ask one thing about that and then follow up with this quote you have towards the end of your book, which I think is important for my students and the listeners and anyone doing criminal legal work or podcasting, which is, so in 1986, so a year after the murder in this case, there's the murder of a man named Scott Macklem. He is shot and killed in a parking lot at the St. Clair Community College in Port Huron, Michigan. Fred Freeman, who now goes by Temujin Kensu, is eventually convicted of that crime. And the issue is he's seen at about noon on the same day, so about 3 hours later, in a karate dojo. This is in Escanaba in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, over 400 miles away. So there's no way you can drive from point A to point B. And there's pretty strong corroboration for this alibi being a true alibi. One of the witnesses at the dojo is Kathleen Dyer. She's a nursing student, and she has class notes, and she recalls Temujin Kensu making a comment about nurses being unhealthy. This is the fat nurses comment. So pretty strong alibi. And so at trial, to circumvent this, the state has the theory that despite Temujin Kensu being on food stamps, he charters a private plane from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, flies it down toward this community college, has a car waiting for him, commits the crime, then flies back and gets to the dojo by noon. And so, Josh, we kind of reported on how ridiculous this was in many levels, but you actually went deeper and went to these private airports. And so what did you find in contacting the people at these private airports?
Yeah. First, just one note for clarity and just to blow people's minds if they don't remember. Temujin had 9 total alibi witnesses who were placing him in the Upper Peninsula when this murder happened much closer to Detroit. You know, this is in southeastern Michigan. So here's where I'm coming from. I'm from the Deep South, a place where snow happens in the movies. So when I hear this, that this dude is up here supposedly in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, taking a flight, you know, to do this, I'm thinking, oh, I don't know what snow people do.
Snow people.
People who live with a lot of snow, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how things are. You know, I heard the people in the Upper Peninsula drive around on snowmobiles half the time. So it sounds preposterous, but I thought, wouldn't it be another thing to prove that it's preposterous? So from being a newspaper reporter, and especially from being a young newspaper reporter, I used to have to cover everything. That included sometimes stuff going on at local airports, tiny airports like these. And I knew from that there's always, you know, some sort of manager, someone running the operation, somebody's in charge. And that's a real person who has a real name, even though it's happened 40 years ago, maybe I can find them. So there are 2 airports in question. One of them was in Escanaba, Michigan, or that area in the Upper Peninsula. And the other one was in St. Clair County, Michigan, in southeastern Michigan. So I found that the guy who ran the fixed base of operations, which is basically where you get the person who's in charge of all the flights happening because he sells fuel and everything and logs and stuff, found that guy. The guy who was there at the airport in 1986, and I asked him, you know, about this theory testified to by a private pilot at the trial, which was that Temujin could have shown up at these airports, at either of these airports, and just by the people hanging around, been able to immediately charter a flight to where he needed to go. He described it as, I think, air taxis. He said that a lot of pilots wanted to get extra time to get another level of their license or something, so they would give cheap rates to people. And they were so into this, they just hung around the airport all hours, and they would do it for anybody. No questions asked. Just give me the money. Well, I asked the guy who ran the St. Clair County Airport about that, and he said, that's nonsense. That's crazy. There was no such service here. The only person who had a private flight service here was the pilot who testified. And I talked to the man who was the manager of the airport in Escanaba back in 86. I told him the story. Asked him if there were people doing air taxis hanging around. And he found it completely preposterous. And by the way, both of these men said the police had never talked with them.
Right. Yeah.
They said I was the first person to ever ask them about this.
Or defense counsel. I mean, let's be fair here.
Right.
Yeah. Totally. Well, that was one of my first thoughts.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the way this happened at trial, it was on rebuttal. This defense counsel had no time to investigate.
Mm.
The best he could have done, which might have worked, was to call those airports and say, hey, this is what they're saying about it. Do y'all do that? But he didn't have the time, didn't think of it, whatever. It didn't happen. And the jury believed this outrageous and falsely premised theory. And where did it come from? Pilot named Bob Evans.
Right.
And Bob Evans, I found out, was a well-liked man in many circles. He was a raconteur. He was a great time. He loved to tell a good story. But when I talked with people who knew him, he never told the story about how he helped send down a murderer.
Mm.
And when I asked a man who was a childhood friend, was a pallbearer at Bob Evans's funeral, why didn't he tell you about this when he told you about all of his tales of heroism? And he said, because I'm a pilot too. And I would have known that he was telling a lie. And I would have told him, Bob, you can't do this.
Why did Bob do this? Was he something, there was a pickle he was trying to get out of? What was the incentive here?
So I'm still investigating that. I will say that one of the investigators who worked on Timogen's case has told a private investigator that Bob Evans had worked for the prosecutor before the trial.
Oh, interesting.
Because the prosecutor was running for attorney general, I believe it was, of Michigan. He had no chance. He was a Republican, and that wasn't happening at the time. But he was flying all over the state. And he was based out of St. Clair. And like I said, the only person who had a flight service out of there was Bob Evans himself.
So is this for a new book you're investigating, or are you working on a different media project?
So I did the initial reporting on this case, investigating on this case, whatever you want to call it, when I was a Knight Wallace Fellow, 2023 through 2024.
Okay.
And what I did, and people who don't know, it's a journalism fellowship, and journalists basically take courses at University of Michigan for a year, don't get grades or anything. And what I did was worked with the Michigan Innocence Clinic, y'all know those people well, I'm sure. And the first thing that they said to me when I got there was both of the directors told me they wanted me to look into Timogen's case because it was like the one they'd been working on the longest. You know, this case has been in the Michigan Innocence Clinic since it opened in 2009.
Yeah.
And so many people, my God, so many people have investigated this and tried to advocate for Timogen. But, you know, he's still sitting in prison. And the thing that's developed more recently is that I am working on a podcast about it.
Okay.
Me and Josie Duffy Rice, wonderful.
Oh, yeah. We love Josie. Okay.
She's awesome.
She's an incredible advocate. Yeah.
She and I are doing, she's going to be the host. I'm going to be the bumbling sidekick. And we're doing that for Pushkin. And I guess it's coming out 26.
Yeah, I've spoken to Josie about the project and the podcast. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what your reporting has found. And on that subject, and going back to The Man No One Believed, again, I highly recommend this book about Dennis Perry and these murders that occurred all the way back in 1986 in Georgia. There's a passage towards the end, and this is so critical to anyone doing true crime, criminal lawyering, my students. There's a passage when you're talking about, I'm out there in the field and I'm speaking to witnesses and I'm collecting all these statements, all this evidence. But it's entirely different when I sit down at home and I'm putting all the pieces together and looking at the big picture. And can you sort of just describe this process of what it's like being in the field and getting all this information, but then sitting down and putting the pieces of the puzzle together?
Yeah, it's I sometimes think that my best reporting happens after I'm done reporting in a way, you know, because I come home or wherever it isn't working. And I go through everything meticulously and I'm able to interrogate things in ways that I couldn't in the moment, you know, because there are different ways to do interviews. My interviewing tactic has always been, we're just two people talking. We're going to hang here. You know, I might tell you some stuff about me, you know, and my life. I want to hear stuff about you. I want you to be so comfortable. You know, if there's anything you don't want to talk, you know. So, and this is how these things come out. And in these moments, I'm trying to be really engaged and, you know, and not keep going over everything necessarily, you know. And that's why you do multiple interviews to ask follow-ups and stuff. But I have so often, in just like the middle of the night, found these tiny little nuggets that, oh, wait, how did I miss that? That's part of the key to the whole thing. And that certainly happened in this investigation. It happens in other investigations that happened the other day, actually the other night, rather. you know, looking through evidence, I found something in a 35-year-old case that I don't think anyone's ever really understood the importance of. And that shows you the importance of repeatedly going through this stuff, going through it. It's not just going through everything once. It's going through everything many times, because each new pass through what you found can reveal things that you missed in the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Again, this was Josh Sharp, his book, which I highly recommend. I flew through it in a few days. The Man No One Believed, The Untold Story of the Georgia Church Murders. Again, telling the story of the wrongful conviction of Dennis Perry and the subsequent arrest of Eric Sparre. So thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you all for your work. I mean, you set me up for success.
I'm really excited to check out the new podcast. Maybe we can have you guys back on when it's out, have you and Josie back on, and our listeners can and check it out and share it on our socials. But thank you again, Josh, for all the work that you do. It's amazing.
Thank you. And thank you all.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions, because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.